Hey, if you're enjoying this show, consider supporting us on our Patreon. You can get cool perks like access to these episodes a week before they go public, and you can pick an album for us to review. Any support is greatly appreciated, so if you feel inclined, go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress.
You're listening to Polyphonic Press, a podcast for music lovers. Join your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke, as they take a deep dive into a classic album and analyze it track by track.
Hey, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
And, wow, it's been a while since we said that.
It's the third time.
But it's the third time today because we've been running tests.
It's just, yeah. Anyway. Yeah.
It's been a while since you've heard that.
Yes.
I guess, is what I want to say. It's just because life happened, but it feels great to be back.
Mm-hmm.
And this time I think it's going to work out because we're not trying to do this as a job or anything like that. This is really just for fun.
Yep. Yeah, that's the way you might have to do it. I mean, I'm nothing against those who managed to get a career. How you did it, I don't know, but it takes the pressure off. It's just easier to get going, and you can avoid the burnout. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
So, for those of you who don't know us, we've known each other since we were kids, since we were like 7 or 8 years old,
something like that.
And we both kind of grew up with parents who had interesting taste in music. I remember my dad had this, he had a CD collection, and then I discovered his cassette collection.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a whole bunch of stuff in there from he grew up in the 70s. He was a teenager in the 70s and into his 20s in the late 70s. So there was a lot of new wave stuff in there.
Okay.
There was
late 70s,
Elvis,
early 80s, yep.
Yeah, there was the B-52s, Elvis Costello, the Knack.
Oh, yeah.
Things like that I grew up on. And then there was these CDs. One of my earliest memories is listening to Radar Love, that song.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you had a similar experience.
Yeah, my dad's record collection was a very prominent presence in our house, and... I'm fortunate to have it within the walls of my apartment here. It's a fairly big collection, but my dad was a musician in the late 70s. So he was a musician all his life, but he was a touring musician in the late 70s. So that's what he was doing at that time. So there was all stuff like that was all over the place when I was growing up.
So long story short, we both come from a long line of music geeks, I guess.
Yeah.
And so that kind of leads us into how this show is going to work. And one of the technology has kind of allowed us to do this, really. Because I don't think we really could have done the show this way even a few years ago. Because how this show is going to work is we're going to be reviewing classic albums. Just albums that we know, that we're familiar with, albums that we have never heard before, artists that we've never heard of before.
Yeah.
And with Spotify, we pretty much have every recorded song at our fingertips, give or take a few.
I've noticed a few gaps, but that's okay.
Yeah. So there's a book out there called The 1001 Albums You Must Hear Before You Die. And I thought, I always had this, there's different iterations of this book. There's ones for films you have to see before you die. There's ones for I think books you have to read before you. There's a whole bunch of others. There's
one for restaurants because that could be a little expensive.
There might be.
Not that I wouldn't try it. Well, at least right. Some of them.
Yeah, but those books are. And I always had that idea in the back of my mind. It would be cool to do a podcast. And I never thought of it for albums. I thought of it for movies. I thought, I don't know. I haven't seen a lot of movies, so it would be cool to just randomly flip to a movie, watch the movie, and give my initial reaction to it.
Mm.
But I thought it would be cool to do albums this way. So how it's going to work is we actually have no idea what album we're going to review. And I've made a bit of a
you programmed a randomized
right.
Yes.
And I've actually, there's more albums in there than what's in the book, because I've pulled different album lists from different sources, and I added a few albums of my own.
Okay.
Cool. That I would like to review, and I'll get John to write out a list of his favorite albums so he can contribute to that as well. Something I probably should have done before I recorded. I thought of it, but I never mentioned it, but we'll do it.
It's first pilot.
It's episode. The first episode. Exactly. So Spotify is, you know, we can just listen to the album there, whereas before we would have had to seek out the album on CD or record or something else that was not exactly legal. And but now that Spotify and technology is kind of is caught up with us, it just allows us to do the show this way. So without any further ado, let's get into it. Let's click the button. We have no idea what album's going to come up. Let's click the button and see what happens.
Alrighty then.
Are you ready?
I don't know. I got to brace myself. No, it's good. Fine. Whatever.
Okay. All right. Okay. You too, the Joshua Tree.
Okay.
Interesting. Okay. I'm sort of familiar with this album. So how this is going to work is we're going to just play the album and just talk about each track as it comes up.
Okay. I think there's a few hits on there I'm certainly familiar with.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, U2 wasn't a huge presence in our house.
So the first track is Where the Streets Have No Name. And I'm somewhat familiar with this song, and I think you probably are too.
Yep.
Okay. So let's get into it. I always like that song. And I mean, The Edge has such a unique guitar tone.
He uses the pedals to like manipulate the tone.
Yeah.
I mean, he still uses the guitar as a guitar by like changing the notes, and still he has a certain amount of a pattern that he uses, but he does most of his manipulation with the pedal board. And it's actually cool. That's not me cutting him up or anything like that. It's a very creative use of his equipment.
Yeah.
And nobody else did it before he did like that.
No. So. No. And I have you ever seen that documentary with it was him, Jimmy Page, and Jack White. White?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Big fan of all three. And yeah, It Might Get Loud. That's a great one.
Yeah. People commented on that and saying that,
oh, he's not a real guitar player.
Exactly, because he uses he only plays a few notes.
But that's not the point.
The point of playing guitar, it doesn't matter how many notes you play. The thing is, does it sound good, not necessarily does it sound good? Is the sound? Are you making the sound that you want to make?
Right. Exactly. I mean, as much as I love a really technical player, a player that has neat ideas. I mean, there's players with feel. Like, I'll take a Stevie Ray Vaughan over an Yngwie Malmsteen any day. I'm not knocking Yngwie. He's a very talented guitarist. He's just a little too static. He's a little too
his
mechanical
approach,
to me.
Mechanical and intellectual.
Yeah. Well, I don't mind a little bit of intellectual, but I love the feeling in there too. I just don't get it with guitarists like that. But The Edge brings it in another way. I mean, it's definitely mechanical because it's, again, a machine doing a lot of the work, but there's still like the human input behind the initial signal. So he's manipulating it from that end. So whatever's going through his looping and you know, echoes and repeating and just feedback loops is still has that initial human input. when it goes into it. And yeah, it's totally legitimate. I mean, learn the rules before you break them, and that's what he did.
Exactly. And the thing that I always like about U2 is they are a band. They're not a musical project. So the guitar player is the one who is creating all these outrageous sounds.
Yeah.
But you still have the bass and the drums that are being played by humans. They're not, it's not a drum machine and a bass loop. It's a bass player and a drummer, Larry Mullen and Adam Clayton.
Yeah.
So one thing I noticed on this track is those two play really well together.
Yes. They're a very solid rhythm section.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're a little bit back in the mix, but
yeah,
they're there and they're still essential.
Yeah. And the thing that sets them apart from a lot of bands in the 80s, think about other new wave. I don't know if I would consider,
no, they were their own thing.
U2 really. New wave or anything, but
they were their own new wave, but it was only parallel with new wave. It really didn't fit in with that sound. They sound nothing like the Cars. They sound nothing like Elvis Costello, you know?
Yeah.
It's their own thing.
Exactly. And, what sets them apart from a lot of bands in the 80s, think about like a lot of the pop music you hear from the 80s. It's very machine driven. It's drum machines.
And it's a lot of DX7s forced upon us.
DX7s and stuff. And a lot of it is because it was new and it's the producers are like, ooh, a new toy to play with. So what that, what sets them apart from a lot of other bands is, yeah, you have the Edge creating all these sounds that, okay, they're very distinct of the decade. The guitar has a lot of chorus and a lot of delay, which is very popular in the 80s.
Yeah, but the gated reverb isn't there.
Exactly.
And actually, the guitar with its really heavy delay on it and stuff like that sounds more timeless like that. Like, I wasn't aware of this sound I probably didn't hear it until the 90s, so I don't associate it automatically with the 80s. When I found out it was recorded, this album came out, what, 81 or something?
87.
This one is a little bit later. Okay, fair enough. I know they were doing stuff in the early 80s and even the late 70s, but I think the Edge found that sound. Anyway, I was surprised to hear it was as old as it was. Mm-hmm. Because to me, like, that gated reverb is just so, it's 1980s. It's going to have
very distinct. Yeah.
And of course, for a lot of us, it drives us completely batty.
Yeah.
But I mean, I've heard it done well. It can be used well.
Yeah. But the problem with the 80s, it was done on pretty much everything.
Exactly.
And it just got boring and tired and all that. The Edge is creating these, I guess superhuman sounds. Yeah. It doesn't sound like a person playing an instrument. It doesn't really even sound like a guitar. And that's the point of it. But to contrast that, you have the bass and the drums and the vocals, the very dry vocals, especially for the 80s.
Yes. That's another thing. Yeah.
And a lot of that is the production from Brian Eno and Daniel Lanois, who both co-produced this record. One thing that's interesting that I didn't notice, and I think maybe there was a radio edit of this song, but the vocals actually don't come in until like 2 minutes into the song.
It's true. You would not have heard that on the radio being that extended. I mean, probably because half the time the radio announcer or the DJ or whatever wouldn't know if the song was on until it's already like, you're already like 30 seconds into it. It's
just,
is it on? Is it playing? Oh shit, I'm speaking during it.
Exactly.
So
And you would never do that today.
No.
Either. I mean, radio, you would never have that much of a gap with just instruments and no vocals in a song that would come out today. You would just never have that. Well, so that would,
I mean, and that's sort of a shame. I mean, I get it if it's like really quiet. I kind of get that, but yeah, there's no instrumental hits anymore.
No.
So, yeah.
And the other thing, too, obviously Bono is an amazing singer. But the thing is, he doesn't have, like, a huge voice.
No.
But he has a lot of feeling in his voice, which I prefer. I prefer singers who have feeling. It's like going back to the guitar playing thing. It's the same thing with vocalists. I'd rather hear someone with feeling than someone who can technically hit all the correct notes.
You know, how auto-tune and what how auto-tune it fixes, in quotations, vocals. In some cases, okay, for some singers, maybe it does fix. For us other singers, it doesn't. It's a crime to put that on there because, and he was actually using like harmonies as an example. And if or even just double tracking actually is more specific. So if you're going to record a singer and you want to double track them, if you auto-tuned both of those parts, you wouldn't hear, you would barely hear it being two voices.
Right.
It would sound like the same voice over again. You need that dissonance between the notes. You need one to be a hair sharp and maybe the other one a hair flat or something to be able to pick apart and actually hear if there's two voices or not. And that adds the interest, that adds the sound, it adds the humanity. And it doesn't sound like it's out of tune.
No, because it's not
really out of tune.
It's not even a semitone off. It's a few cents.
Yeah.
But getting back to the song, as an album opener, I think it really works as a way to open up the album, especially with that slow build of the intro.
Yeah.
That's a really cool way to open up the album.
That's dynamics. Or, dynamics.
Yeah.
You need that.
So
maybe
let's
move on to the next track.
Yeah, I was gonna say, let's get into the next song. The next one is I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For, which is another song that I know. So let's hear that. A lot of songs don't fade out anymore.
Yeah, they don't.
That was really a 70s and 80s thing.
Yeah, it's true. They don't tend to do that. Well, and a lot of people used to say that sounded like really lazy producing. But honestly, it sort of depends. I mean, it's nice to write an intro, but sometimes it actually gives it sort of a feel if you let it sort of just play out. Like the band jam and then turn down the volume while they're playing. You know, that had a pretty good groove to it.
That really did. Yeah. Like the way the bass was just going, just kind of thumping along. Yep. It's just that hypnotic sound. And again, it's done by humans. There's no beat correction. There's no time correction or anything like that. So you have that. It's not perfect. It's like you said, it's grooving. Yeah. You know, I think, the two guys, Adam Clayton and Larry Mullen, the drummer and the bass player, I don't think they really get enough credit as a solid.
Like, no, it's true.
Or just in general as, in terms of talking about music, I think they kind of get overlooked, but they really are one of a really great rhythm section. I think that just comes with, cause they've been playing together for so long.
Exactly.
I mean, they're like 10 years into their career at this point. So.
I mean, if you've got a sign of a great band, I mean, there are some bands that sometimes can get away with it. But if you got a drummer and a bass player that seem to always be there, and after a little while, you'll notice that they're lock in step because they just know what each other are going to do.
Yeah.
You know, unless
you're... Look at Mick Fleetwood and John McVie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that I think I know Mike Campbell joined Fleetwood Mac, and I saw an interview with him, and it is true, is they are probably the longest running rhythm section in rock and roll history.
I would say so. Yeah, probably. What's the name? Original bassist for the Stones. He's not there anymore.
Bill Wyman. Yeah, he quit in like 95 or something.
92, I think.
Yeah.
So. You got Sloan. That's another, like, no changes in that band lineup for 30 years now.
Yeah.
Tom Petty got away with it. It's funny. Tom Petty got away with it when he replaced Ron Blair with I can't think of his name. Sorry, names are escaping me.
Howie Epstein.
Howie Epstein. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, that was a whole other thing because, well, I mean, Stan Lynch was such a unique drummer.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about that. Let's talk about how U2 has managed to keep its original lineup from their first album up to now.
Yeah.
Which is pretty amazing and very rare.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the original lineup going back to what, when the band formed, which is like,
well, I think they may be changed,
but since the first album, you're right.
I think the first album was in 1980 or 81.
Yeah. So already that's
40 years.
That's 40 years.
Plus years.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. And I think, honestly, I really honestly believe that the way to keep a band together is to split the money evenly.
It really is. Yep. Try to encourage each other to sort of bring an equal amount of, output to the band, input to the band. Man, I'm just thinking, you know, back to that rhythm section thing. I was thinking just how incredible Cream could have been if only Ginger Baker and Jack Bruce could get along.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They couldn't stand they played each other so well for too long, and they were amazing even for they were around for 2 years, really, on top, like, to top it out.
Yeah.
They were always at each other's throats.
Yeah.
And, oh, man. But, I mean, even before Cream, they were with the Grand Bond organization, and that's how they were. They still didn't like each other then either.
No.
So, whatever.
But I'm just looking at on Wikipedia here, and Brian Eno has a songwriting credit. Bono has two writing credits.
Yep.
Just him. But the rest of the writing credits are credited to U2, mm-hmm. which means that the whole band is sharing songwriting credits, which means they're splitting the money evenly.
Yep.
And I think that's honestly the way to do it. I think that's the way you keep a band together.
Yeah.
Because the two examples, like you said, Sloan, that's mm-hmm. how they do it. U2, I think Coldplay does it the same way. And I don't think anybody's quit from them. I might be wrong about that.
Yeah, I'm not really 100% sure about, you know, the band dynamics or anything. I'm really not an expert on Coldplay. But I do know that they certainly get a lot of their inspiration from U2, and it wouldn't surprise me if they've taken like sort of a band dynamic ideas from U2, because why not? It works. So, you know, if you've got a perfect example of what you want to do in front of you sound wise, and you realize it worked like for a very long time with them, it might not be not a bad idea to find out why.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I can't knock them for that one.
No. Yeah. I honestly believe that's the secret to keeping your band together. It's just split everything. I think maybe have the band be the company or entity and have all the revenue come through that. And then everybody gets what they get.
Yep.
But, let's get into the next song, which I think is another hit.
Yep.
With or without you.
That's 3 for 3. 3 for 3.
Right,
I mean, that's a strong intro to an album. 3 hits.
Yeah.
That song's been in, you know, hundreds of movies, and I know that song.
Yeah,
I've heard that song all my life.
Yeah, it's a good one.
I know it uses that chord sequence that gets made fun of a lot, but yeah. I don't actually have a problem with songs using that chord sequence.
Not really. If there's so many things you can do with it, like the song structure around it is still very, very different. I mean, even though you can use the same chords, and there's honestly, there's only so many yeah. to use. I mean, people invent things all the time, and people are going into like multi-tone or microtonal stuff, and you know, which I've only heard used well on a, like I can count them on one hand.
Yeah.
King Gizzard and Lizard Wizard, like the number one band that I think actually uses it well. But yeah, it's true. I mean, that chord, it's very used, but if you've got the song, like the melody flying over top of it is so different enough, it really doesn't matter. I mean, you can't, you know, and again, I think lots of people have made this argument before, but everything is somewhat derivative. I mean, even if you're not conscious about it, something is influencing you when you create something new. You've heard right. something or seen something or tasted something, and it's giving you the idea of what things to put together to do whatever.
Exactly. I mean, look, a lot of bands get compared to the Beatles because they essentially are the blueprint for a lot of modern rock bands, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. But they didn't do everything original either.
Of course,
I mean, they had influence. They like Paul McCartney, especially in the early days. Paul McCartney's voice is very much influenced by Little Richard.
Yeah. And they were playing rock and roll hits. That was their first few albums. It was like at least half, you know, covers and stuff like that.
And the originals sounded like those songs. Yes, too.
It's true.
You know. Nothing. And then, you know, those influences were imitating someone else. And then those were imitating something else. It just goes back further and further and further. So it's just, so to be completely original or to try and be completely original is, it's like, why?
What's it's kind of a futile attempt. I mean,
exactly.
You can come out and you can sound really strange even, but you're not the first person to come out and sound really strange. So that's also been done. Good grief. You've got John Cage, his, what was it, four something or other time. It's basically 4:33 or something like that. I can't remember. Yeah. And it's just that amount of time of dead silence. I mean, once he's done that, what can you do that's actually like new, not been done?
So, exactly.
And even then, silence isn't exactly new. He's just pick a time and recorded it.
Yeah.
So
it's in class. It's called a rest.
Yes. Really.
It's just a really long rest.
I think his is actually a bunch of rests, but yes.
Yeah.
I'd like to point out that in that song, I noticed when it was starting up, you could hear the Ebo sound in there.
Yep.
And back to that sort of like imperfection is perfection sort of thing. I heard the signal drop out a couple times on his guitar as he's playing it, and you can sort of hear where it sort of cuts or something like that, and you don't necessarily want to fix all that. You don't necessarily want it to be one continuous note or, you know, a perfect sequence of whatever. It's those little imperfections that sort of give it almost like a natural feel. It's a completely, like, electronic, unnatural effect, but it gives it that, you know, that feel to it, and it just you don't want to fix all that.
Exactly. And people who don't necessarily know a lot about music will say, well, why do you care? What difference does it make? And my argument is,
you notice it.
You might not even be aware of it. You might not even be conscious of it.
Yeah.
But someone who doesn't know much about music, and they just hear music and they like what they like and they don't like what they don't like, whatever, it matters to them, even though they might not be aware of it. They might not know why something sounds off.
Yeah.
But they know that something sounds off. Or this song is interesting to me. With or Without You is interesting to me. I can't really tell you why it's interesting, but it's an interesting song. And maybe it's because of those imperfections, but they're not conscious of it, but they're picking it up on a subconscious level.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing how all these very and U2's a very polished sounding band, but I mean polished without sound, you know, being auto-tuned and beat detected to death.
Right.
It's still a very polished sound, but it still sounds organic.
Exactly.
And it's because they allow whatever happens in the studio to happen. They get a good take, but there's just little things that, you know, you can't control and you don't want to control at all. I mean, that's where the magic happens.
Right.
And also, you notice how the song structure is so simple, but that's not a bad thing either. It's
right.
It's really an exercise in how space, like playing between the notes where the music actually, in a lot of cases, happens. And you can really, in this song actually showcases the rhythm section a little bit higher. I noticed like you can really make out the bass and the drums come into it. It's a little bit higher in the mixing parts.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
And I noticed on this song, there was a lot more reverb.
Yes.
And I think that was obviously a choice to give the song more space.
Yep.
Because there's so few instruments happening.
Like there's a largesse, but without filling in all the, like with playing, you're letting it sort of like flow together. Like it's like taking, like painting like a circle and then putting like with like water paint or something like, and you put water on it and it sort of blurs it out. And then you paint another circle and you do the same thing. And when they bleed together, it's still just the two circles, but there's the wash together sort of gives it like this sort of gradient effect.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what they're doing with the sound. And that's what the echo and the reverb is doing. So.
Yeah. And this song is, I was just reading about it, and what it's about is, Bono's inner conflict with being, because at this point he was married. I don't know if he has a kid or at this point, but he's married. And his inner conflict with being a domestic husband, but also being a touring musician and the lifestyle that comes with that. And from his vocal performance to the lyrics, the lyrics don't come right out and say it. He's saying this all in metaphors.
Yes.
But the vocal performance and the instrumentation, the way that, like we said, the minimal instrumentation, lots of reverb, giving it space. That like the sentiment of the song, it, like everything just fits with that sentiment. The way it kind of builds up, his vocal performance gets more intense towards the end.
Yeah.
That just all fits together with that sentiment,
as well as the buildup of the drums, because the drums get a lot heavier. Like you can almost like sort of graded on a perfect graph going up. You know, the drums start out very quiet, and as it gets to the end, they're really pounding away, and the bass is no difference. We're just carrying along, and they're in lockstep with each other. So
exactly. So moving on. So this, I was just reading a bit about this album, and that song was actually from, doesn't fit in with the overall theme of the album. That was actually written for the previous album. But this record, apparently the overall theme, it's not a concept record or anything like that, but the overall theme is U2 at this point had toured America quite extensively. And the idea, the working title of the album was Two Americas. So it's Joshua Tree, if you don't know, is actually a national park in California. It's actually where people go,
to smoke peyote.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Or whatever psychedelic of choice.
Choose your poison. Yeah.
Right.
Hang out in the desert. Try not to die.
But they have these, I don't know if these, they are called Joshua trees, and I don't know if they grow anywhere else in the world.
I'm not sure. It seems to be just the elements are just right for these types of trees. I don't know if there's like another place that grows them. I know they're very, protected. They're protected species. I think there's actually a huge fine, at least, maybe even prison time if you like kill one.
So. Yeah. So I think that title is like a uniquely American thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of the album was the mysticism or romanticism of America. This is the land of opportunity, a land of freedom and all that. While that's happening, there was also, this is in the 80s, and Ronald Reagan was in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, we've we basically just went through Reagan 2.0.
sort of. He's a little different.
A little different, yeah. But essentially the same.
Yeah.
So it's the idea of the idealistic version of America and the reality of America. So now I think, given the title of this next track, Bullet the Blue Sky, I think we're going to hear a little bit of that. So I'm curious to hear what that song is all about.
Mm-hmm.
So without further ado, this is Bullet the Blue Sky. Sound like you too?
Not quite. No, it's definitely a bit of a different. What would you say? It's a definite approach. It kind of sounds a bit like U2, but it sounds like the U2 playing the part of a different band. Like the fact, I think the primary thing that really changes the dynamic is the fact that key echo thing that we were already talking about with the edges playing is been completely replaced by, you know, a roaring slide guitar. It's a very different approach for the U2.
Yeah, but it still makes sense.
Of course.
With them. And you know what? I actually, my immediate reaction was, this sounds like Nirvana.
It kind of does. Yeah, this is when it's starting to sound a bit like grunge. Yeah.
Yeah. Could be, especially the snare drum. Like that ringing snare drum.
Yeah.
Is like it almost is breaking my brain right now, the fact that that sound existed in 1987.
Yeah.
When I associate it with like 1996 ska punk.
Yeah. That sound. You know what actually that song really reminded me of? It reminded me of the Tragically Hip. Like, take out Bono and put in Gord Downie. And
yeah,
that's a very Tragically Hip sounding song.
Very much so. And
it's before they were really a like known thing. I think their first album came out in 87, but this was their second album that was their breakthrough.
Mm-hmm. So. And very fitting with the theme of the album, especially with some of the lyrics, I couldn't actually quite make out a lot of what he was saying.
Yeah.
But yeah, like this is obviously the sentiment that I get with it is there, because the drums and the bass again are very tight, very solid, but the guitar sounds very disjointed and angry and pissed off and
upset.
Exactly. Yeah. So the contrast between the two is very like very fitting with the theme of the two Americas, the idealistic, very put together America, and then the reality of how crappy it really is.
It can be, yeah, for some, you know. For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so the next song is Running to Stand Still. So let's hear that one. When this song first started, I wasn't sure about it, but as it went on, I found myself slowly getting drawn in by it, and just kind of hypnotized by it.
Yeah, I sort of knew what you meant, but I think the slide acoustic caught me again. It's U2. You don't necessarily expect slide guitar. You don't really expect acoustic guitar. You don't expect both.
Right, exactly.
So that actually hooked me, and I was thinking, you know, this is, you know, it's starting out slow, but that's all right. A lot of their songs have this build up, and this one did that at the same time. It went up, and then it sort of arched. It kind of, you know, kind of like the headstock of a Gretsch. So it just kind of curves up and then humps over and then curves back down.
It was sort it was a journey.
Yeah.
It was a story. The cool, I was, the this is how good of a band that they are. So the lyrics to this song
fit the structure of the song.
They do.
Yeah, subject matter does for sure. Running to stand still.
Yeah. So the lyrics were painstakingly worked on. It's about two heroin addicts in Dublin, which is where the band is from. There's this apartment building that's notorious for drugs. And it's a fictional tale of a couple who are addicted to heroin living in this building. So the lyrics are worked on just, you know, they worked on the lyrics. Urbano did anyway. But the instrumentation was completely improvised.
Okay.
They set up in the studio and they hit record and that's what happened. So it was completely in the moment, not rehearsed. They didn't know what they were going to do. That's how good of a band they are. That's how well they play off of each other.
Yeah, they just kind of knew each other. I mean, it was sort of a simple enough concept, but still to pull it off the way they did.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, and it's that, you know, perfection within imperfection sort of thing again. They just, again, let whatever happens in the studio happens. And so long as it's a good take, they don't really need to fix much. And just let the little things be the little things. It's a sort of a laissez-faire, but honestly, it takes a lot of discipline to get to that point.
Yeah, exactly. And they couldn't do that on their first album.
Probably not.
There's no way they could. That's just them playing together for so long. They get to that level of nonverbal musical communication. They can have a song where it's all the instrumentation is completely improvised and they know exactly where each other is going.
Yeah.
And that's the mark. That's just the mark of a great band. Whether you like their music or not, they're a great band.
Yeah.
They play so well
with
each other.
I've got to say, they're not one of my favorite bands, but I appreciate them. And this album, I agree. This is a good album. In its essence, absolutely. And the thought just hit me that I would pick one other band to sort of be like a contemporary of theirs for their time. I mean, there's lots of bands that sort of came out, but you could say that they were sort of influenced by U2 because they had their own thing. But I'd say a band that sort of like followed sort of in the same vein. They're really not exactly the same. And they're not even from the same place, but I'd say REM was like the closest thing to being the same genre, if you can even call it that.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that. Yeah. That's actually, it's funny because U2 and REM get compared a lot.
That doesn't surprise me at
but
all.
But I agree. And the thing is that people say about those two bands is, no two albums really sound the same, and yet it always sounds like
them.
Like U2 doesn't sound like REM, and REM doesn't sound like U2. But you can see the similarities, and it's always distinctly them. But I totally agree.
Yeah, and again, Michael Stipe and Bono's singing, they sound nothing. If you just put them in a room, you know, on their own and just recorded them separately and then said, this is like, these two bands are what I would call a similar genre. And you go, what the hell? This guy's basically kind of like mumbling and he's just kind of like spouting off random things here. And this guy's singing his heart out over here. They sound nothing alike. Just, yeah, but you didn't hear them in their context.
Exactly.
it's amazing how a band can sound so different and yet sort of have come off with the same, it's a vibe. They put out a similar vibe. One band's from Georgia and the other one's from Ireland, and yet they've got this, and separately they sort of created the same vibe by doing different sounds, really. It's interesting how that sort of came about. Art's weird, man.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's get into the next one. This is called Red Hill Mining Town. There's no going back to hands of steel and heart of stone. Our labor day has come and gone. Okay, so Red Hill Mining Town, that is almost a country song.
Well, sort of. I don't know if it's fair to say. I felt like so far that's the weakest song yet. It's not a bad song. I wouldn't say it was a throwaway, but it's not up to the same standard as everything that's come before so far.
No.
But that's, I mean, not everything can be, you know, bang, bang, bang out of the gate for, you know, vast whopping majority of stuff. But yeah, it seemed to sort of chug along, and it didn't capture my attention the same as the other ones did.
Yeah, I agree. I think, it's not quite a throwaway, but it's sort of a dip in the middle of the album.
Yeah, it's, I thought, guitar part, there was sort of an interesting sort of like finger pick sort of sound to it. And I guess that's where they're trying to allude to a little bit of a, that sort of country feel. And I get that. And again, they're trying to keep the theme of like a wide open space around them sort of thing. Because again, coming from, well, you know, England and really any other place in what, you know, could be the European Union. Yes, I know they've left the European Union, but, like America looks so big. Everything's just like there's so much extra space. And people from other, you know, from more populated or more concentrated populated countries, that's what they're always talking about. It's just they're blown away by how long it gets to get from one city to another. Sometimes the cities can be packed, but there's a lot of space in between. And they're trying to get that sort of sound from, you know, their perspective. That's what it sort of feels like being in that country to them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of like, country music, I guess, from an outsider's perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I agree. It wasn't, it's like you said, it's not a bad song.
Yeah.
Just not, it's not a song that stands out to me.
Yeah. That's fair.
So I want to get into we only have a few songs left, so I don't want to spend too much time. So I want to get to the next one. This is a song called In God's Country. Interesting fact. Bad song, not the best song on the album, but
again, I think it beat Red Hill Mining Town. I think it's better than that one, and
yeah.
I think maybe it's just because there's a lot more energy going on in it, and the rhythm section had some time to shine in it as well.
This actually sounds more like early U2.
Yeah,
I think the song's like New Year's Day. I don't know if you know that song, but
I think so.
This sounds very similar to that. It's funny because I was just reading about the song, and this is probably the band's least favorite song.
Interesting. It's funny. We were talking about how they weren't really like a new wave band. That song sounds almost like it could have been in sort of like a new wave, maybe even sort of a punkish structure for them.
Well, they said, what was it here? They said they knew it was not going to be one of their best songs, but they needed a more up-tempo song for the album. Developed out of Bono's frustration at, trying to get a bit of rock and roll out of The Edge. Bono tried to inspire the Edge by teasing and playing on his competitive instincts by claiming to be a better guitarist.
I don't know how well Bono can play. I mean, I've seen him definitely play, you know, rhythm, you know, in context to him. But yeah.
But he was saying that to try and get something out of the Edge.
It was like a dick move. I hope it worked, though.
Well, yeah. Daniel Lanois called it was recorded in the Edge's basement studio.
Okay.
And Daniel Lanois said it was a muggy little room where everything sounds dead. Not a particularly inspiring place. It's funny. It's weird that the band feels that way about this song. And maybe it's just because it does sound like early U2, and it's like, okay, we're just flexing our muscle at this point. We're not really doing anything new. We're just,
that may be, I think it, yeah, it's partly like how they went into it. Like, again, it's really hard to change. I mean, when you're a listener listening to something for the first time, you know, it's all new, it's all fresh to you. Whatever you're feeling in that moment will often be, you know, how you feel about that thing. In many cases, that can sometimes alter over time. But when you're the band who's actually producing it, there's hours of preparation going into this thing, and it's really hard, if it's tainted in any way, it's really hard to break that. I mean, something amazing has to happen with it in order to sort of break that, and clear that the song, it just didn't happen, because again, it's a in quotations throwaway track on the album. It's not really a throwaway. It's, again, I think it's better than the previous low point.
Yeah.
I think it's actually decent. I don't mind it at all.
No, it's a good song, but I can understand where they're coming from with that. It's just like, we know this isn't new territory for us. We're not, this is kind of uninspired. But you know, at the same time, I've watched enough documentaries on the makings of albums and read books and stuff. Writing songs and making albums and recording and getting all the sounds right, it's hard.
Yeah,
to put a collection of 10 songs together that
you got four moody artists in a room and you have to make them all get along and not long enough to put out, you know, 10 or whatever songs.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's not the easiest thing in the world. And, you know, people listen to albums and or with any medium, whether it's you know, movies or music or whatever, people don't understand the amount of work that goes into it and how hard all of it is to put it all together. So, you know, as a fan, this might be your favorite song on the album, or I'm not saying it's your favorite song, but it might be one of someone's favorite songs.
It could be. It's good enough that it could be someone's song.
Yeah.
It could mean something to somebody. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Also, I think like the fact that it sounds like early U2, sometimes it's nice to know that a band can go back to their roots if they want to or need to or whatever. It's just nice to know sometimes that they can. Just like, yeah, we can still do that. Because oftentimes you'll hear a band and they go through, you know, they change. And I love it when a band evolves, but when it's good. And sometimes it gets to a point where a lot of these bands are like, it's almost, they're impossible to do what they want to do. Whether they want to or not, they can't get there again. Whether there's too much technical knowledge that they can't have that naivety that they needed before. That's just one way to do it. I think that's a primary example, because lots of bands start out being, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I'm just in here. And then the other times they're, you know, 10 years later, they come back and they're seasoned veterans. So two different, and sometimes they just can't get that old spark back.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're jaded veterans and then they really can't get that old spark back.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. No, so many bands go through that. I don't know if U2, I don't know much about U2's career. They might've gone through.
I mean, this is still what I would call their peak. And this is early on in this being like, look back on 10 years of what we're playing and go back. This is still like relatively within the past 40 years, fairly early in their career. But this is a peak as well. There's lots of people who will say that their newer output isn't quite up to this standard, and sometimes I agree.
Well, I mean, so, I mean, you can say that about any band too. Really, I mean, it's I think a lot of the time bands or artists, not just bands, but artists too. I mean, I think Bob Dylan hit his peak in about 1976. And
it sort of depends because I'm a big fan of his stuff in the mid 60s when everyone was yelling at him to get off the stage because he went electric. That's kind of my favorite period.
Well, he finished his peak in the late 70s is what I mean.
Yeah.
He sort of had this trajectory, and then his 80s stuff was not that great.
He was still writing good songs, but again, it was that 80s production that was thrust upon a musician that really. So many bands that started in the 60s and 70s just had no business putting out albums in the 80s. I mean, they can still write, but they just, the sound did not fit. This is so many of them. But yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah. It's hard to, once you've written all your great songs.
Yeah.
Like how many great songs does one person have in them?
Really depends. Again, it's that spark. Some bands will literally like, wow, apparently there was like a mark of like 65 or 101 or something like that. And after done that, I can't find a good song anymore. And other ones, you know, till they drop dead, they're still putting out, even if it's not every song, they're still putting out good songs in like regularly.
Let's get into the next one here. This is a song called Trip Through Your Wires. Beatles song, that's what that would sound like.
In some ways. I was trying to figure out
60s jangly.
Yeah, it's sort of, it had a little bit of a jangle pop sort of a thing to it. I was trying to pin what exactly that was, you know, kind of doing. It had this like sort of almost like a ballady role, but I wouldn't call it a ballad. It was sort of interesting. And again, you can sort of it's kind of interesting to see how people don't really realize how flexible the band actually is, how many different styles they can sort of go onto, and yet they still sound like you too.
Yeah. Well, I think about that song. It's not on this album, but the song Angel of Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
That is a totally different song than like the drums and the bass. And that's, it's basically a Soul Stax Motown kind of thing that we're doing. But the way that the drums and the bass groove, like, it doesn't sound like U2.
Yeah.
So it's just,
The stuff on top of it does.
Exactly. Yeah. And it just shows the versatility of this band.
Yes.
And that they can wear many hats, but it still sounds like U2.
Mm-hmm. And, but you notice that, the hits, I mean, other than some of the examples that we've shown, and you know, they've stepped away a couple of times, but when you think of a U2 hit, there seems to be the sound that kind of really pegs what's successful for them, and sometimes that can be the death of a band. They become like a one-trick pony because they always have to chase that one sound. I'm not saying U2 is, well, they certainly weren't, where was I going with that? It's just a band can have like this, you still have your own sound, that sort of just pegs through whatever style you can throw yourself into, really, I guess.
Yeah. And it's not like it's a planned thing or anything like that. Yeah. That's just the way they play.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is, I'm just realizing like what an interesting band U2 is.
Yeah.
Cause I've never really paid that much attention to them other than the hits. Like, yeah, I like them and I listen to their hits and whatever, but I never took this much of a deep dive into.
Oh, I know what I was going to say. I was going to say, sometimes it takes a deeper dive into the albums to find out how versatile the band is. there, the idea is finally gotten out. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
ADD. It's a curse. And a blessing sometimes.
Yeah.
Occasionally.
So we've got two songs left. So I'm curious how this album runs out, how it goes to the end. So the second last song is called One Tree Hill. Here we go. So that had the potential to be my favorite song on the album, but let me tell you why it's not.
Okay.
I like songs that have that jumping sort of rhythm with the way that the synthesizer was doing it, and I think throughout the whole song it stayed on the A chord, and then for the chorus it went to the G and the D, and then stayed on the A. I like those changes, and I like when there's subtle chord changes like that, when most of the song stays on one chord and then it change. I like that.
Yeah.
So all that works together. But I think the instrumentation for the rhythm of the song and those changes, I think it was too sparse.
I think that's sort of intentional fit with the album though. But I think, I know what you mean. It sometimes, especially on an album that's full of so much space, sometimes it's nice to break it up with a few more notes here and there. Maybe.
Yeah, I thought they could have added a few more instruments. I thought they could have filled the sound out a little bit more. I think there was just too much room in this song for that rhythm and that. I just wish that if they were going to do something like that, I wish they just went for it 100%. Rather than just,
it might have been another hit on this album.
Yeah.
Could have been kind of neat. I kind of liked how they threw in like a sort of, I don't know if it was a cello, but it sounded like a cello. And then they added the instrumentation. But the fact that the cello, it sounded almost normal for a bit. And then it started getting, altered through some sort of, I don't know, phase shifter through or something, and I don't know whether they got a cellist in to record it and then played with his track, or whether that's the Edge messing around with a new instrument or doing something weird with his guitar. I don't know. I've heard people do any of them, wouldn't surprise me. But I also like that when that sound started, like further on in the song, when that sound started to build up and you thought it might have been that cello coming in again, and then you realize, no, that's like a really clipping distortion on a guitar. And then it sort of turns into like this, really raunchy sort of guitar riff that kind of carries out into their, false stop before their... And the false stop was also really interesting. And then he sort of finishes it off with like an extra PS or something on the end. It's kind of neat. So
yeah,
there's a lot going on in that song that was really good. So
there was. Yeah. And that's why I said this had the potential to be my favorite song on the album. If they had just gone for it 100%, it would have been, but I just think, and they didn't necessarily even have to add anything else. I think it just could be mixed differently.
Maybe, it'd be sort of interesting to get the mixes and see what's hiding in there. The masters, I mean, get the masters and sort of play with it. Move up a few faders, see if there's something hiding in there. Oh, that's cool. That should have been in there.
Yeah.
That'd be cool.
But I think it was just too quiet, and there was too much room that could have been filled out on a song like this. Whereas a song like, I can't remember the name of it, With or Without You.
Yeah.
That's a song that calls for a lot of space, whereas I don't think this one necessarily does.
Yeah. I don't know whether it was the band or if it was like Brian Eno, whatever, whoever's decision that was, It was probably to fit with the rest of the, I mean, it's not a concept album, but it's definitely got a theme or a character. And I think they wanted it to fit the character. And I guess maybe it does. I think they probably could have done a little bit more with it, and it probably still would have fit the character. I mean, there's a few songs in there that sort of broke away a little bit, but they still carried that space. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything on this album that doesn't have that space. There's still one song to go, so we'll see.
That's true. That's true. And that's a good segue to the next song, which is the last song. It's called Exit.
Appropriately.
It's the last song, which is a appropriate title, yes. So, last song on the album, Exit. Wrong, there is another song. It's just not showing up here.
That's weird.
But yeah, that's weird. But that was an interesting song.
Mm-hmm.
Very different from the rest of the album.
Again, but still lots of space.
Still lots of space. It's apparently a song about being in the mind of a serial killer.
Huh. Funny, I didn't quite catch that listening.
But it still makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
This song definitely has a spooky kind of vibe to it. It almost reminds me of like Nick Cave or something like that, where it's that dark kind of, you know, spacey, spooky kind of unknown territory kind of thing.
Yeah.
Especially the night sounds with the crickets and all that. Very interesting song.
I was listening to that song and another thought just sort of came to me. This is how my brain works. Anyway, bands like U2 and a lot of the bands that sort of came out after them, such as like Muse and Radiohead, it's almost like they're almost like jam bands in a UK sense. Like you can listen to like the Allman Brothers and like the Grateful Dead or something like that, where if they got they're jam bands, but they got this Americana to them, and Fish is no different, really. It's a little bit more of an updated version of pretty much sort of like the same just a continuation of the tradition, really. But the UK sort of does sort of the same thing, but it comes off very different. And they're not really considered jam bands, but maybe they kind of should be, but they just have this, it sounds nothing like, you know, the Allman Brothers, but if you sit and listen to them, they could be a jam. They could take that sort of thing and take it places if they allowed themselves to just, you know, jam on it. And it's just a very, you know, I think it takes a certain amount of ears. I think a British or a UK audience, be it Irish, Scottish, whatever, Welsh, they'd probably be able to withstand it more than, say, an American or Canadian, you know, North American audience generally would. With some exceptions, of course. This is just an over generalization. Whereas, you know, we have people who will follow the Grateful Dead over a cliff. I think bands like U2 have their followers that would probably do the same thing if they, you know, did something like that. I don't know. This is just me speculating. It's just, I get that vibe from them, and that last song really gave me that sort of a vibe of like a jam band that doesn't sound like a traditional jam band. But I heard other bands in it, and I just started thinking, they could kind of do, it's the same, similar sort of thing that I never really quite got before, but I think I kind of get now. So that's just where
I'm. Yeah. No, I agree. It's interesting that you say that, because I never really thought of that before. But yeah, you're right. And I got, just as you were saying that, I got thinking, like, are there any British jam bands? But I think
they're,
it's
not
pretty
called
much
jam bands, if there are. Yeah.
No,
it's a different kind of thing. But if there was, I think bands like this, you know, and again, I think U2 and Muse, and I said Muse. I said another one. Radiohead. Yeah, they kind of do that. They would fill that role in a lot of ways.
And, interesting. And
occasionally, maybe in some shows, they actually do that. I don't know. It'd be kind of neat to find out.
Yeah, and like I said, I got a lot of... It reminded me, because maybe I've been listening to him a lot, it reminded me a lot of Nick Cave. That sort of... the darkness and...
Yeah,
and not the band, the darkness, but the darkness of the...
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, yeah.
The subject matter, the overall even sound, the mood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very gothy kind of vibe to it, which... I've never associated you two with goth culture.
But there's almost like I could hear like traces of like almost like a Trent Reznor thing going in there. Just that one track. Just a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Hmm.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I was going to say that initially when we were talking about The Edge, he's another guy that uses technology and things like that creatively. He doesn't use it like we were talking about, like audio tune and that. He doesn't use it to correct things. He uses it in a creative way.
To make more mistakes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's a certain amount of truth to that. I'm not knocking it. I actually prefer it.
Which actually, that gets me into the whole other thing, is the using auto tune to get that robot voice. I'm not a fan of that, but I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah. I kind of respect it. I respect that more than when it's used to sanitize everything to the fact that you just polished all the personality out of something.
Exactly. I forget what I was going to say, so let's get... This is
move into the third song. I'm sorry. Did I talk over your thoughts?
No. I kind of talked over my own thoughts.
hate it when that happens.
It turns out I was actually wrong, and that wasn't the last song.
There's another song.
So this is the last song.
Why is it not showing up? I don't know.
I don't know. But it is playing. It's just not listed. So this is the actual last song, called Mothers of the Disappeared. That song was like that. That's all Brian Eno.
Yeah, it's very Brian.
Yeah.
Although there's a few textures in there that I was a little surprised to hear, and one of them was like, there was a keyboard sort of note sound. It sounded like my Farfisa on like a flute setting. It's just the do 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 do. It just sounded like that, and it's sort of interesting to hear like an instrument like that. That would be, you know, considered ancient analog technology in the middle of 1987. It's a little, you know, it's interesting. I'm glad they did it. I don't know how they did it exactly, but
yeah. And you know, I wouldn't be surprised if it was a Farfisa on that setting. I mean, you got to think like Brian Eno came from that, you know, with Roxy Music. He was, you know, a child of the 60s and grew up with those sounds. So. Yep. It's not out of the realm of possibility that that's exactly what that is.
But yeah, and he certainly didn't shy away from the stuff that came after, though, either. So
yeah, no, that's for sure. I think actually, you know, this song actually does have the feel of... It's interesting that I don't know if because you mentioned it, but this actually does feel like a hidden track. It's not. But it doesn't. It really doesn't fit with the rest of the album, but it still works as an album closer.
Mm-hmm.
Still
lots of space.
Still lots of space.
Yep.
A lot of ethereal kind of... It reminds me of like a CD you would... I don't mean this in a bad way, but it reminds me of a CD you would buy at the airport that have like sounds you would fall asleep to.
Well, it's funny because Brian Eno's got that song... Songs for Airports album, which is basically just experimental I guess you could call it music, like in the basic sense, but really it's sounds.
Yeah.
And I sort of get it. I think it'd be stuff like that would be very popular now on, like, you know, those like ASMR sort of channels or, you know, liminal spaces or something, like that, you know, showing like video clips of basically an empty space, just watching whatever going on in the background or something like that, playing this music, and people would be like, oh yeah, I'm into that vibe. Apparently people hated it when they actually played it in an airport. People much mm-hmm. preferred, you know, the music that they would play in airports in general. That's the difference between people. And you got to do something. I mean, if people are going to hang out in a place like an airport or a shopping mall or something like that, I could definitely see where playing a bunch of random noises is just going to chase a lot of people out.
Yeah.
I got to say, it probably wouldn't even like vibe with me every day I went in there. Some days I might be into it. Other days I'd be like,
oh, I'm
what the hell?
Yeah, working there would be.
Yeah, exactly. Be happy.
Getting back to the what isn't a piece of crap is this album. So what are your final thoughts of the overall album?
I get why it's a classic. Mm-hmm. I actually really do. There's the first three songs, you put those on and you just go, well, this is obviously a classic album. There's three hits on it, and I haven't even gotten to the fourth track.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but the rest of it, it fills in the gaps, and there's still a lot of really high notes, and you get to really hear the band do things that, again, you don't generally hear them do. Kind of a shame, really. It'd be nice if everybody, you know, the general public had more of like a perception of what the band actually capable of doing, and instead of expecting, you know, the one trick that they expect of the band, or the few tricks, because they're not just one trick, obviously.
Yeah, and what I can definitely see is, I having listened to this album now, it's obvious why this band has such loyal fans.
Mm-hmm.
I can see, like, I don't think U2 is ever going to be my favorite band, yeah, but I can see why they would be somebody's favorite band.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So that, in a nutshell, is U2's Joshua Tree.
It's and a our big take, nutshell.
Our initial reaction to each track on Josh, I guess it wasn't really a review because we didn't go too deep into the lyrics and all that, but this was our, I guess, initial reaction to this album. So if you've made it this far, thank you so much for listening. Hopefully at some point you will be able to get this podcast on all the usual places like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and all that.
We'll try that out at some point.
You can... if you want to support the show, I want to make it clear that this show will always, 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 always be free. But if you do feel so inclined to help out the show, you can support us on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress. And that's about it. Unless you had anything else to add.
No, just look for the big orange block with a little white T.
Exactly. And on that note, I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.
You have been listening to Polyphonic Press. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Polyphonic Press. Check out the website, polyphonicpress.com. Feel free to drop us a line at polyphonicpressmusic@gmail.com. And finally, you can support the show by heading over to patreon.com/polyphonicpress.